Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I am Ben Rhodes. It has only been 3 days since our emergency pod, and that feels like about 3 years because a lot of things have happened. We began Monday with a call for a potential summit between the President of Russia and the President of the United States. And that feels like a really long time ago because we saw Vladimir Putin really cast the die yesterday. We saw him hold a Russian Security Council meeting with his top advisors, in which they each, looking very threatened and uncomfortable, endorsed the idea of recognizing the so-called People's Republic of Donetsk and People's Republic of Luhansk, the two Russian separatist-controlled regions of Ukraine that we talked about on the last podcast. Then after that meeting came a very long and very troubling and rambling speech by Vladimir Putin in which he seemed to question Ukraine's very right to exist. And we get into that today in a very fascinating conversation that I have with Max Seddon, who's the FT Financial Times reporter in Moscow. Then on Tuesday, we saw Putin double down on his announcements from Monday as Russian lawmakers gave him permission to use military force outside of Russia to back the separatists and to back the claim of the separatists to the entire Donbas region. And so you'll recall from our last podcast, right now, the Russian-backed separatists only control a portion of that area. Russia has now authorized the use of military force to essentially claim the independence of the entire region of Donbas. And I think, based on Putin's rhetoric, there are obviously worries that he's going to go farther than just that. Putin also gave a list of three demands that had to be met by Ukraine and the West: international recognition of Crimea as part of Russia, an end to Ukraine's NATO membership bid, and a halt of all weapons shipments to Ukraine. So Putin continuing to set the diplomatic bar far above where he knows the United States or the West is willing to go, and certainly the people of Ukraine have been willing to go. The world's leaders and diplomats have decried the situation. They've blasted Russia for violating Ukraine's sovereignty, and we've seen the beginning of some sanctions in response. This includes Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz announcing the suspension of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia into Germany. This is a major step that will impair Russia's capacity to export energy into Europe. We saw the UK sanctioning a number of Russian banks and three oligarchs in what was a less dramatic announcement, but nonetheless the first step out of the UK. We saw the European Union's top diplomat say that a package of sanctions has been approved by unanimity with member states that will hurt Russia and will hurt a lot. Then we saw President Biden today announcing the first wave of U.S. sanctions in response that also included a number of Russian banks and a wide net of Putin-associated oligarchs and cronies targeted with sanction, while indicating that there'd be more. And I think this is just a first step out of the administration. I actually think that the most powerful statement in response to what Putin's been doing in Ukraine came from an unlikely source. And it was at a meeting, an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, from the Kenyan ambassador to the United Nations, Martin Kamani. Here we have a brief clip.
Kenya and almost every African country was birthed by the ending of empire. Our borders were not of our own drawing. They were drawn in the distant colonial metropoles of London, Paris, and Lisbon, with no regard for the ancient nations that they cleaved apart. Rather than form nations that looked ever backwards into history with a dangerous nostalgia, we chose to look forward to a greatness none of our many nations and peoples had ever known. We must complete our recovery from the embers of dead empires in a way that does not plunge us back into new forms of domination and oppression.
So, what does all this mean? I think we've been pretty clear the last few episodes that the assumption was Putin was going to do something. The nature of what we've seen the last couple of days is about as troubling a scenario as we could possibly face. Because in Putin's speech, he really wasn't focused principally on even questions about NATO or European security, despite the recognition of these two so-called People's Republics that are basically invented by Russia. He wasn't even focused on that. He was focused on deep-rooted historical grievance and a sense that not only has Russia been wronged, but that Ukraine itself shouldn't even really exist. He even cast the blame on Lenin, on the Soviets, on the Bolsheviks for somehow creating Ukraine, which is not at all true. But this was the ideology of a man that does not seem like he's going to be content simply recognizing a couple of invented people's republics in eastern Ukraine. It did feel like someone preparing the Russian people for a much more significant escalation. It didn't seem to be a man who gives a shit, frankly, about global condemnation, global sanctions, global efforts to call out what he's doing. It seemed like somebody who's been, frankly, waiting a long time, maybe his whole life, for this particular moment. As you'll hear in our interview, it also seemed like a man who is deeply, deeply cut off from any voices, any advisors, any countervailing forces who might be urging caution or restraint. If you look at that Security Council meeting, clearly Russia has become a place that is entirely a one-man, one-rule scenario in which it's terrifying to voice opposition to what the leader, Vladimir Putin, is ordering. And even in the nature of his announced deployments into eastern Ukraine, we see all manner of pretext for escalation. So allegedly to Putin, these Russian troops are moving into eastern Ukraine to be so-called peacekeepers. That inevitably, combined with the fact that they're claiming the entire Donbas region, will offer him plenty of opportunity to claim that somehow Ukraine has been the aggressor. And we continue to see propaganda, disinformation, and Russian media alleging all manner of Ukrainian aggression against either Russian forces or Russian-backed separatists or ethnic Russians or Russian language speakers. So everything feels like it's coalescing behind a strategy of continued escalation into Ukraine. I think it is notable that we saw such a swift announcement of sanctions, including, and probably most importantly, the cancellation of Nord Stream 2 pipeline, given that Germany had been seen as the most cautious and reticent to move to significant sanctions. But we should be clear that, you know, it's quite likely that sanctions don't really matter to Putin, that he's priced this in, that he thinks he can weather them like he's weathered sanctions in the past. And the reality is he's got a lot of cash. He's got a big rainy day fund there of over $600 billion, as we've talked about. And when you're talking about the short term, you know, he can weather it. I think the bigger question is, again, whether he is overreaching dramatically and whether the combination of Russian casualties in Ukraine and an economic hit to Russia and a direct hit potentially through these sanctions, if they're enforced robustly to his inner circle, can ultimately boomerang back on him. But that will take some time. And in the interim, we could be faced with a very damaging and destructive war in Ukraine. And we talk later on the show with Samantha Power about what the USAID is doing to prepare for humanitarian contingencies, including masses of displaced people and refugees out of Ukraine. So, you know, look, we're in a perilous moment here globally. We're in a perilous moment in terms of the risk of escalation, because Putin could respond to our sanctions with cyber attacks or efforts to destabilize democracies, to mess around on NATO's borders and other countries like Moldova, to potentially even mess around in NATO itself. And today the U.S. indicated that it's preparing to send troops to the three Baltic countries, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, as a part of that continued effort to reassure them. So this is going to be with us for some time now. I hope that the worst kind of escalation does not take place, that there can be some kind of off-ramp from this. But I think, as you'll hear in our interviews today, we also have to be prepared for the possibility that we just are dealing with a 69-year-old leader of a nuclear-armed country who has always been willing to be not just autocratic at home, but aggressive abroad, but who may be even in a different phase of his own life and his own leadership that can put a lot of people at risk. So with that, we're going to move after the break to my interview with Max Sedin, who is the FT reporter in Moscow. And then we will hear from Samantha Power about USAID's efforts to both respond to the situation in Ukraine, but also Sam walks us through the latest in terms of the effort to promote vaccination around the world to deal with COVID, and ends on a bright spot. I hope you stick around to the end, because Samantha takes us around a tour of some of the bright spots of the work the USAID is doing around the world, but also some of the bright spots for democracy and some new strategies that have been embraced in combating autocracy and kleptocracy. So stick around for it. And after the break, we'll hear from Max Sedin.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Visit a live archaeological dig site on the very grounds where America began, or walk the fields where our country was won. Live like a colonial by day or track 18th century ghosts by night. For all the history to be found here, there's plenty more to make for yourself. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Okay, we are very pleased to be joined by Max Sedin, who is with the Financial Times in Moscow. He's been with the Financial Times since 2016 in their Moscow bureau as a reporter. He was previously a foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, as well as a reporter for the Associated Press in Moscow. Max, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to start, obviously, with Putin's speech and kind of very unusual televised National Security Council meeting yesterday. Was there a sense, there's been so much warning, obviously, out of the United States about this impending war, and Russia seems to have veered between ridiculing the warnings of war while kind of turning up the dial on their, you know, charges of Ukrainian ethnic cleansing or aggression, in particularly in the Donbass. Was there a sense yesterday that this is the ramp up to war? This is the kind of thing that Putin is going to do if he's really going to not just recognize these two Russian-invented republics, but actually go into Ukraine more significantly?
Oh, absolutely. It was a completely shocking speech. I think even among everyone who's watched this troop build up in slow motion over the last few months, so what was really taken aback was by just how angry Putin was, in the way that I'd never really seen before. He seemed almost personally affronted by the existence of Ukraine as a country in its current form. And he made it extremely clear, hour-long speech, doesn't really get into the whole Donbass issue in eastern Ukraine where the separatists are until about minute 45, 50. And you do not make a speech like that if all you are doing is just preparing to recognize these states. It's very clear this is something that's been on his mind, that he is under this deep COVID isolation for almost 2 years now. He spent a lot of time reading some incorrect history books and talking to some people with some pretty bizarre ideas. And this is the result. This is it.
Yeah. I'm glad you raised this. You know, Putin's obviously been in charge for a long time. My recollection, right, in 2009, when he was prime minister, when Obama comes into office, Medvedev is president, did feel like there was a kind of larger circle of people that at least had some input into what was going on. You could feel even by the end of the Obama years that that circle had kind of shrunk. And then we reached the point yesterday where we watched really just a performance where these advisors were, you know, almost afraid that they were going to say the wrong thing, you know, and it feels like he's listening to nobody except the voices in his head. I mean, you've been in Moscow a while. What is the sense of how big or small Putin's circle is, and how that might be shaping what would be, you know, obviously the most consequential decision, even with all the things he's done, probably of his presidency, if he goes with a full invasion?
I think that what we really saw was that there is no circle of around Putin anymore. It's like Louis, I believe Louis XIV of France. Check that. L'état c'est moi. I am the state. And this was really the defining moment in what you could call the third act of Putin, where the circle of people around him has got smaller and smaller, and so has his worldview. I talked recently to a former senior official in the Kremlin who said that it used to be that he sees everything in 360 degrees. Now it's more like 60 degrees. And so in terms of people who he talks to, the first 10, 12 years, maybe really up through to Crimea, that was the sort of the fake news era, of what was called managed democracy, where they kept many of the outward trappings of democracy, but they governed not really through repression, but through fake news and manipulation and things like that. Then and the sort of clashes that were described were between the so-called Siloviki, these people with KGB backgrounds. Many of them were actually in the KGB counterintelligence with Putin in Leningrad in the 1970s, and they control pretty much all the security ministries, a lot of the state companies. And on the other hand, you had these people who were called the systemic liberals, who were more the ones that, you know, you would have been dealing with. And Putin was seen as almost this kind of King Solomon figure, like he was this arbiter between them. And then Crimea was the point where he broke with that definitively. And If I'm getting my facts right, when he decided to do Crimea, he had a Security Council meeting that was inconclusive. Then, by his own recollection, he stayed up until 7 a.m. with four aides, the three security guys, and Shoigu, the defense minister, where they decided to do that. And what I thought was very symbolic about this meeting yesterday, it was in the same fancy room in the Kremlin where they had the ceremony to annex Crimea. And this show you how, even compared to that, things have really shifted to the point where it's not, you know, that he's the sort of, you know, arbiter. It's not even that there's some sort of little Politburo. It's really he's become the czar. He's become the god emperor. And what was really remarkable to me was these people who you know, your average armchair criminologist, and I absolutely put myself in that category. We were all writing articles, you know, really, you know, up to the minute that happened, saying, oh, you know, Putin, his circle is getting smaller and smaller. He's only listening to these guys who say a lot of crazy things, like the West is collapsing because of gay marriage and people want to have sex with animals. Yeah. And I'm not making this up. Like, the head of Security Council says this all the time. Yeah. And they want to destroy Russia and things like that. But then we got to see, not live on TV, because it was it was some sort of prepackaged thing that they just put on TV without warning. But it was you saw some of these same guys pretty much grilled by Putin to say what he wanted to hear. And I was wondering afterwards, what was the point of even doing this? If even during the meeting, Mishustin, the prime minister, he said, you know, we've been preparing for the economic consequences of doing this for a few months now. And obviously the troops, you know, didn't arrive on the border yesterday. And you don't act like Putin did. You don't do this theater of saying, oh, I haven't discussed this with any of you guys. You know, I just really want to hear what you think. I'm like, oh, great, you all think the same thing. And then turn around a couple hours later, oh, by the way, here is my hour-long angry speech that I wrote myself, as the Kremlin confirmed today, after spending God knows how long poring over these strange books that he reads and original historical documents as well. I thought about this, and the conclusion I come to, and this is just my speculation, but what it really felt to me was that it was some kind of loyalty ritual. There's a Russian expression, a kruguvaya paruka, which is a sort of mutual, not so much as responsibility, as almost a kind of guilt. It was like he was trying to get them all to say, you know, this is where we're going. I want you all to all publicly say that you're going down with me, because you know, some of them did not look particularly thrilled about having to do this. The prime minister, Mishustin, he basically tried to sneak out of there, and Putin was like, hey, where are you going? Oh, come on, say, like, do you want to recognize the separatists or not? And then there was this absolutely extraordinary scene. I nearly fell out of my chair watching this. Was you had Sergei Naryshkin, the head of foreign intelligence, one of the three people who go back to the very, very beginning with Putin in the KGB, and he's seen as the most sophisticated of them because he was seen as good enough a spy to serve in the West during the Cold War. We don't even really know what he did when he was there. And he went up there, and both he and one of the other biggest hardliners, Nikolai Patrushev, the head of the Security Council, they both suggested, oh, maybe we should just use this as a threat that to try to force Ukraine and the West to give us what we want in a matter of days. And then Putin started grilling him. He said, you know, Sergei, speak clearly. What do you want? And then Naryshkin just starts, he looks really flustered, starts stumbling over his words. And at the end, he says, oh, I do support it. I support bringing the Donbass into Russia. And Putin had to say, well, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about recognizing their independence. And Naryshkin's like, oh, yeah, great, great. I'll do that. And
trying to remember the right answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've just, I mean, obviously it's a, you know, it's a highly stage managed process. It was edited. There were some speeches that weren't shown on TV. We don't know what some of these people said, but at the same time, it was this really unbelievable message, not just to the public and not just to the people in that room, but I think to, you know, everyone who's working in the Russian system is, you know, I am the arbiter. This is my decision. Only I decide. If I can do this to my closest allies, you know, just think what will happen to anyone else who steps out of the line. And there it goes. And the optics of it, of course, were just unbelievable, because Shaw Walker for The Guardian made the point on Twitter that, you know, out of all the times, you know, that Putin actually needed a really big table because you had 22 people in the room with him, he didn't use it. He's in this desk, and all these officials are just lined up on these chairs about 20 feet from him, so they can't breathe on him, apparently. It seems to be some sort of weird social distancing measures that aren't grounded in any recognizable science. And one by one, they're made to give these kind of school reports to the principal. It was just absolutely stunning, like the sort of thing it's the Tsar's court, really, is what it reminded me of.
Yeah, and quite worrying too. I mean, it's never a good thing when leaders with some of his impulses become that isolated and have that degree of absolute power. I think it's important for people to understand that you can be a dictatorial autocratic figure and not have kind of total control. But you know, clearly the optic he's giving is that he has this kind of total control. I wanted to ask, you know, we've talked, including on this podcast, for instance, we had John Nemtsova on talking about, you know, the contrast with Crimea in that case, you had this kind of patriotic euphoria in Russia. A lot of Russians, you know, truly believe Crimea should be part of Russia. Alexei Navalny has said as much to me when I've talked to him about this. But you don't sense that now, you know, and it's hard, obviously, to get a sense of Russian broader public opinion. What is your sense of the mood there? I imagine that politics is not easy for people, even just kind of ordinary people, to talk about. But beyond, underneath all this propaganda, you know, what do you get a sense of the Russian people's appetite for more war, more escalation with the West, more sanctions coming their way? How firm is the support underneath all of the theatrics we watched yesterday?
I think there actually is a little bit of polling on this. If you look at the Levada Center, which is the only independent pollster that really operates in Russia, and they've been under a lot of pressure from the government. They did the poll at the end of last year showing that, you know, on the one hand, the Kremlin's messaging on what's happening and who is responsible, it seems to be broadly working, but at the same time, people aren't really that interested in it. And the Denise Volkov from the center has said that really this just isn't what people are worried about, because real incomes are down something like 10% since the annexation of Crimea. That's actually not really much to do with the annexation of Crimea. The sanctions haven't really had that kind of effect, but people are worried about pocketbook issues. Inflation is rampant. What people are worried about are the prices of staple goods, what the mortgage rate is, and things like that. And you couple that with the fact that the Donbas, Eastern Ukraine, unlike Crimea, there was never the same kind of sentimental attachment that even you know, supposed liberals like Navalny have with Crimea. The use of that back in 2014-15, the propaganda, I think, was really more than anything else to make Crimea look good, because the message that it sends, and last time I went to Crimea was in 2016, every single person I spoke to said this, so that absolutely worked, was you don't want it to be like this, do you? And obviously, you know, people don't want their homes to be shelled with artillery. They don't want their friends and loved ones to die. It's a pretty simple and powerful message, and one that they were quite successful in blaming on the West. The problem now is that if you know, the U.S. intelligence is correct, and we do see some sort of massive onslaught in which, you know, 50,000 people might die in a few days. That's a lot harder to sell. And I've had people even in and around in the Kremlin not just admit this to me, but insist it themselves, saying why the American reports are wrong, because they wouldn't be able to sell, you know, if the Ukrainians are a brotherly nation, then why are we killing them? And even if they could sell that, then if you really want to sack Kiev, a lot of Russians are going to die too. And you've removed the element of the kind of fig leaf of covert action that you had in 2014, when it was scarcely credible that they weren't heavily involved in and indeed directing the conflict. But it allowed them to do things like minimize casualties. You had things like Wagner, the mercenaries that were created basically as a sort of cannon fodder in places like Syria. When you have an open war, on the one hand, you can do a lot that you couldn't do otherwise. Like, they could use airstrikes to neutralize Ukraine's armed forces very effectively, because Ukraine doesn't really have any air defenses. But at the same time, there is a big downside. And speaking of Navalny, he just did this big post on Instagram today where he said that this could be, you know, in some ways the beginning of the end Putin, in the way that for Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union, because you've got to the point, he said, where these guys, they think they're great players on speaking of Brzezinski's great chessboard, and they have gotten to something that they can't really control, that's going to have huge consequences for them, and they can't really get out of.
Yeah, no, I mean, that I saw that was, you know, definitely seizing the moment from Navalny. I wanted to ask about those consequences. We've heard a lot about sanctions, right? So we've heard about export controls to deny inputs to the Russian economy. We've heard about sanctions on Russian banks. We've heard about efforts to go after the wealth of Putin cronies and oligarchs who have money in the West. Today, Germany canceled the, put on hold at least, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. What sanctions do you think the Russian government is most actually worried about? And what sanctions do you think would be most consequential, both to that inner circle and then more broadly to the Russian economy and public?
I'm not sure any of them actually are that effective, because if what you're talking about is the goal of changing Russian policy, this is something that even Obama, when he was still in office, he admitted this had not happened.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a sort of tendency, you know, maybe, you know, I know some people on the anti-kleptocracy side in the US and UK will disagree with me, but there's this sort of tendency where it almost feels to me like it's like people say about communism, you know, these anti-kleptocratic sanctions, they've never been implemented properly. Whereas if you if you follow it from here, what it looks like is you can have the effect. There are various studies of how many percentage points of GDP Russia has lost because of sanctions. Some are between 1.5 and 3. I remember off the top of my head, World Bank and IMF done some studies on this. But in terms of the actual goal of imposing costs on Putin to get him to change his behavior, it really has the opposite effect. There's this kind of rally round the flag drive that you see where it becomes almost a kind of loyalty test, much in the way that the Security Council hearing was. If you want to understand not just sanctions, but how Russia under Putin works, you only have to do one thing. You have to find, I think it's been translated into English, Novaya Gazeta, the independent Russian newspaper whose editor won a Nobel Prize last year. In 2014, they published the leaked transcript of the meeting of the owners of the Russian soccer league teams when they had this vote to decide whether to admit the Crimean teams into the league. And you have some people like Vladimir Yakunin, who's this ex-KGB guy who used to be very close to Putin, then was kicked out after one too many corruption scandals. And he's saying, I'm already under sanctions because I'm a patriot. You must suffer too. And then you have this guy, Sergei Galitsky, who owns the biggest supermarket chain in Russia. And he says, you know, guys, you know, I am ready to suffer if that's what the president wants. But I'm the largest private employer in Russia, so I would like to know that this is actually what he wants. And then someone says, well, why don't we call him and ask him what he wants us to do? And everyone goes, oh no, that's terrifying. So going back to sanctions that could work now. I don't think it necessarily matters if you sanction, you know, whether it's 3 oligarchs like the UK did today, or whether it's 300 oligarchs. They're not going. I think it's a fantasy, to be honest with you, that they're just going to go to Putin and say, hey, Vladimir Vladimirovich, you need to get the tanks out of Ukraine. I'm about to lose my villa in Biarritz. And the way that Putin thinks about this, I think, is also it's changed and it's very hardened. He said a few times recently, including in his pronouncements on recognizing the Eastern Ukrainian separatists, that it doesn't matter what we do because they would find some sort of reason to sanction us anyway. He basically he thinks that Russia
he probably believes that too.
I think absolutely he believes that, and not him, but some of his top people have said this many times for years now, that they think that the U.S. is basically hell bent on destroying Russia, breaking it up into bits, and using Ukraine as a tool to do that. In terms of what's on the table, I think Nord Stream 2, I think that is certainly a that is a big deal. I was surprised that Scholz went that far, seeing as, you know, he's new to the job, only been chancellor for a few months, and he comes from the SPD, which is a party of Gerhard Schroeder, who is the godfather of Nord Stream and just joined the board of Gazprom. And I think that obviously long term it does create a lot of problems for for Gazprom because they can't sell the gas. All you have to do is to look at the maps of where does the gas go. You know, gas is not like oil. You can't put it in a barrel and just ship it somewhere. You know, the pipelines, they go where they go. And the gas fields that are in the European part of Russia, you can't just turn around and send them to China either, because the Ural Mountains are in the way. So it's something that's very difficult to do, and that is a big long-term problem for Russia, but also it's somewhere where Europe is going to suffer. This is a problem that's always been at the heart of sanctions policy, that it's very difficult to do anything really broad without punishing yourself. So if you look at banking sanctions, it's very difficult to completely cut the biggest Russian state banks out of the global financial system, because you need a loophole so that Germany and Italy and other countries can pay for the gas. Look at titanium. Boeing gets so much of its titanium from VSMPO and ISMA in the Urals. They can't really replace that at all. We saw this in 2018 when the U.S. did sanctions against Oleg Deripaska and Rusal, and then had to spend next 9 months basically doing this kind of embarrassing climb down because it was so disruptive to global supply chains. And that is the irony of, you know, the globalized economy. You know, Tom Friedman, he thought, oh, no two countries with McDonald's will ever go to war. Well, not only that, but actually this interdependence, it makes it more difficult to stop countries like Russia from ripping up the rule book, as it were.
It's interesting, you know, and you mentioned the kind of anti-kleptocracy crowd, of which, you know, I guess I try to be think of myself as part of that. But the one of the things that has gotten less discussion is what Navalny does, right? Which is essentially the publication of and spotlighting of the wealth and corruption, which you have to think, at least if you look at their reaction to Navalny himself and his network, that does seem to make them uncomfortable, you know, because that's what he was doing, and look where it got him. I mean, I guess to end the two-part question, one is, do you think that's something that worries, if not maybe Putin, the people around him, the kind of a kind of relentless effort to expose the degree of wealth that has been accumulated, and then using that. What is your sense of the current state of Navalny, his trial, and how he might be impacted by an escalation? You know, is there concerns that if there's a war and there's Western responses, that the already brutal crackdown there might get even worse and might kind of feel like Soviet days, people disappearing and the like?
So I'll start with the second question. So my wife is a reporter, actually, and just yesterday she was in the prison where Navalny is being held, because he is currently on a new trial that is going to keep him there for another 15 years at least. And he said himself that, you know, Mandela was in there for 30 years. They're just going to keep tacking things on. I think it's very difficult to see circumstances under which he gets out of there while Putin is still alive, the way things are going. And he sounded very much his usual self. They sent this guy to testify against him who was some sort of plant who worked in some sort of minor role for a short period of time many years ago in one of his offices, and then he's become this sort of professional Navalny hater. He has his own show on Rush Today, which was co-hosted with Maria Butina, who you may remember for quite some time. Yeah. And this is nothing but criticize Navalny. That's all that it does. And of course, the show is in Russian, because that's, you know, in many ways the real audience for a lot of the stuff is the people who are paying the bills for things like Rush Today at the end of the day. And so he was very much enjoying just absolutely ripping this guy up on cross-examination, and from, you know, what my wife said, from what I could see on Twitter and so on, it sounded like it was absolutely brutal. But at the same time, there were very few journalists even in there watching, because Ukraine has really consumed the world's attention. There was one point, because they won't let reporters take electronic devices into the room, and my wife was sort of in there with just him and the court personnel for a bit while the Security Council meeting was happening. She was like, Alexei, what, did you know this is happening? He was like, what? No way, this is crazy. And I don't think it's not necessarily, you know, that everything boils down to Navalny. I think for Putin, Navalny is, a major irritant, but something that comes from a larger problem, which is what we talked about earlier, that he thinks the U.S. is trying to destroy him. And he said this many times. He thinks Navalny is a CIA agent who's been sent to destroy Russia. But I think it's definitely very convenient timing for this trial that they've done it at a time when if you believe people like the prime minister or some people in the Russian parliament whose remarks have come out recently that they've been preparing this for some time. I don't think that was an enormous coincidence. So they decided to do that. The problem with Navalny, who I've been following him for something like 10 years. I've interviewed him maybe a dozen times over that period, and he would have these sort of rises and falls of success and popularity, and there'd be points where he'd do some really spectacular things. Like 5 years ago, he did this video about Medvedev that was the cause for these huge protests, and I thought, oh, you're just never going to top that. That was just a really, really good video. Then they did the palace, and the response to that was huge. But the problem is that if you are that kind of democratic opposition in Russia, you are really like the frog in boiling water, where the temperature keeps rising and rising and rising. People on the outside are getting used to it, and there comes to a point where the pot actually is boiling and you boil to death. And I think it's also the, and so the result of that is all these things they just become normal very, very fast. I remember a year ago when they named the first journalist foreign agent, and this was absolutely huge, huge scandal. Now it's got to the point where I have friends who are Russian reporters who they check the Justice Ministry website every Friday to see if they've been named foreign agents, and they haven't been named yet. So they go and get drunk when the list comes out, and they're not on it. It's become this kind of normal thing, and it's not for nothing that the title of Navalny's blog was The Final Battle Between Good and Neutrality, because in many ways that's what he's had to overcome. And if you look at the video, it had something, the Putin's Palace video had something like 125 million views on YouTube or something like that. But it just doesn't necessarily translate into people on the streets. And also, not everyone who sees that video in Russia, this is a dynamic that I think is underappreciated sometimes with a lot of this corruption stuff. It's a bit like Trump, where people don't think, oh, this is so corrupt, and why does Putin's toilet brush cost more than my monthly wage? They think, wow, what a cool guy. I wish I could live like that. Respect.
Some people, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's like more and more widespread than a lot of people realize.
Yeah. Well, look, this is, thanks for sharing. This is really good insight into kind of what's going on there. I won't ask you to predict the events that in Ukraine, because it's happening by the day. But the main takeaways for me are, the incredible kind of isolation and control that Putin has, that kind of means that he almost doesn't need to prepare the public as much as you might normally, because he's the guy calling the shots, and that's the main message that he's trying to
I don't think he cares. If you want, I can quickly run through the options, but I actually
go for it. What do you think the options are for them?
They sort of range from grim to extremely grim, with tens of thousands of people dying. So one thing is what we talked about earlier, that you had some of his security officials suggesting that they use recognition as a kind of stick in some sort of negotiations with the West. I don't think that the Biden administration or the Europeans are much interested in having those kind of talks. But I talked to some people in and around the Kremlin who seem to feel like this is it. This is where they're going to stop. They've sort of done it. This is as far as they're going to go. Option number two is we still don't know, again, what the borders of the separatist states that Putin has recognized are supposed to be. And remember, the ostensible pretext for this is that they are under Ukrainian attack. And they've been saying today that the Ukrainian attacks are not ceasing. So it's very easy to imagine Russia signing some kind of pretext. And it's been striking that even compared to 2014, when it was pretty obvious to anyone who paid close enough attention that so much of this was fabricated. Here it seems like they're not really trying, and you get this impression that a lot of the people in the system, that they might not have even really known that this was coming. Just a week ago, when Putin said that they were going to withdraw some troops from the border, there was this 2-day dunkathon on state TV going, ha ha, you guys predicted the invasion, it didn't happen, and then they started laying the groundwork for recognition on Thursday. So I think Russia has already claimed that it was in some sort of direct firefight with Ukrainian saboteurs who made their way onto Russian territory. It's the first time they've ever acknowledged fighting any Ukrainians directly, and in the entire years of the conflict. And it's very obvious it's very easy to imagine some sort of scenario where they claim that they've come under attack, and as Putin said, Ukraine will be held responsible for the ensuing bloodshed, which was the chilling note that he left us all on last night.
Nothing good.
Let me just leave you with one more quote. I was speaking to one of the very few Russian commentators, analysts who saw this coming in some shape or form, Tatiana Sanovaya, who's a political consultant, and she said something at the end of our conversation that just made my hair stand on end. I just said I don't know what to ask you after that. Where she just said, the goal is to end Ukraine's existence in its current form. No Ukraine, no problem. And that just stunned me into silence, basically. And if you look at what Putin said, he really just seems genuinely affronted by Ukraine existing. And the threats were not very veiled. He said, you like decommunization? Well, we'll show you what real decommunization is. And if I were Ukrainian, or even me, just myself, I think that's very worrying.
Yeah, no, it's the, throughout this ramp up to where we've gotten, the idea that, he's just trying to control the politics in Ukraine, or he's just trying to leverage it for negotiation, or maybe he'll just bite off another chunk of the East. That doesn't feel like what's happening. Unfortunately, it feels like the more worst case scenarios are unfolding. But hey, look, where can people follow your work, follow you on social media, or watch for your articles?
Yeah, so I'm Twitter at Max Sutton, and I post pretty much everything I write at the FT, and of course we are FT.com. This is not getting off our homepage or front page anytime soon, I don't think. So
That's right. Well, you've been great to follow on this stuff, and really appreciate you joining us here.
All right, thanks for having me.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Chapter 1, Wayfair welcomes you to the Waberhood. Our hero, Titus Burgess, ambled down the stylish street of an enchanting utopia. A woman waved from a chic lounger. "Welcome to the Waberhood," she said, "where Wayfair helps everyone create a home they love." Titus stared in awe. Bohemian Boulevard, Trendsetter Terrace, Mid-Century Circle.
Titus, you're reading the Wayfair catalog.
Oh, you'll love Chapter 2. Wayfair's fast and free shipping saves a potluck.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
And now we're very pleased to be joined by the USAID administrator and best friend of the pod, really, Samantha Power. Thanks so much for joining us, Sam.
Thank you, Ben.
So I want to start with the situation in Ukraine. And I guess just to situate our listeners, I wanted to ask you, what has been the nature of USAID's engagement inside of Ukraine? And I imagine that through that engagement, you have both staff and kind of civil society contacts who are there. What are you hearing from them? Are you concerned about them? What's the state of play for USAID right now?
Well, it's a great question because it's a great window into what Ukraine itself has made itself since 2014, and the last time we were in the midst of a crisis of this magnitude. Basically, USAID has worked since 1992, but really concentrated since 2014 to build a more resilient, democratic Ukraine. You know, the people spoke and wanted to integrate with Europe. They wanted to build a rule of law. You've met a lot of the young people who got involved in either civil society or, really interestingly, unlike a lot of countries in the region, in politics, actually becoming MPs and becoming part of the scrum. And what has been amazing to me since I've come to USAID is to kind of unpack all that the American people have done in support of that effort. So it's everything from what you'd expect, training of judges to try to strengthen the rule of law, anti-corruption mechanisms, to making it easier to start a business in Ukraine, because of course we want there to be economic opportunities as part of the democracy dividend that has been lacking so often when there's been a democratic opening. So a ton in the economic space, but as you know, a real emphasis on independent media, on not just, again, the anti-corruption bodies and trying to make the government change and liberalize, but the oversight mechanisms outside. You know, whether it's the journalists doing the muckraking, or we have people also tracking disinformation, you know, partners of ours who we support as they prepare daily or weekly digests on just what the latest disinformation play is by the Russian Federation. Our partners do a lot near the line of conflict, because we know that Vladimir Putin's number one goal is to convince people in Russian-occupied territory that everything that happens on the Ukrainian government-held side of the line is hostile to them, is about denying them economic opportunities and other things. Again, part of this propaganda and these lies over so many years. And yet the best antidote to those lies is actual exposure and collaboration and cross-line work and cross-line cultural and artistic projects and so forth. So it's one of our largest missions, the USAID mission in Ukraine, and it's on everything from strengthening democratic institutions to strengthening democratic watchdogs to also working with the government on things like cybersecurity and energy diversification. So if you think about what is the toolkit that the government needs to move to the next phase of its journey, which is looking westward and giving its young people an opportunity to modernize and become part of the democratic world, that also includes making sure that the institutions are in place to protect against cyber attacks and to be able to be energy independent ultimately, which is something that the people in that country crave in light of the intimidation and bullying that has been such a feature of life in Putin's neighborhood for so long.
And now with the movement of the embassy from Kyiv to Lviv in the West, and the kind of downsizing of it, what does that do to your presence? I mean, presumably you're part of that discussion. Your people are moving too. Obviously not the people who are grantees, but your staff. Do you still have a presence there?
Yeah, let me say a few things about sort of what the recent weeks and months have entailed, because everything I've just described to you is our programming building this new Ukraine, this democratic and we hope more prosperous and more independent Ukraine. Of course, as Putin has put his forces on a war footing and deployed them and created the specter of mass violence in Ukraine, our emphasis has shifted a lot to humanitarian contingency operations and what that might look like. So thinking through the various scenarios, and we still, as we speak today, of course, don't know precisely what scenario we are likely to be operating under, but we want to be in a position to support Ukrainian people if they move in mass from the towns where they are currently living, if they come under shell or shell fire or missile attack. We want to be able to ensure that the shelter provisions, you know, the cash that they might need if they've had to leave their homes in a hurry, that all that is ready too. So, you know, starting really in October, November, December, we were calling up the Europeans, calling up the UN, trying to get people to focus in advance on what what our intelligence and our messaging, you know, indicated was afoot, which is that Putin was moving toward doing something unprecedented, even for Putin. And yeah. Initially, honestly, Ben, it was hard to get people's attention. You know, people, all of us really have a hard time imagining things we have not yet seen. Yeah. And so all people could really wrap their minds around was a slight escalation along the line of conflict, or maybe even a significant escalation, but believing that the systems that we've been drawing on since 2014 would be sufficient. And we were saying, no, look, there is a very significant possibility that this is going to be a much more extreme scenario with a mammoth invasion that moves people out of lands where they have been living, even as the conflict has occurred in the East. You know, the situation elsewhere has been relatively stable, and it was hard to get people's attention. So what we have now are we have our development partners on the ground who do the cybersecurity, the energy, the civil society, the journalism work. Those are run really on the ground by Ukrainians. Mm. And while there is, of course, an American presence and an expat presence, and many of those individuals have left the country, heeding the warnings by the State Department and others, Ukrainians are still there saying, you know, we want to stay. We've lived under the specter of Russian violence for a long time, and they are not going to deter us from doing this work, from fighting misinformation, from strengthening the rule of law. I will say that's gotten harder the last few days as it starts to dawn on people, you know, with 150 to 190,000 troops perched, you know, that programming may be in jeopardy. Yeah. And so now we're working with them to make sure that they can telework if they need to, you know, that they need not necessarily work from the areas that they were working. If they want to continue doing the work, even in this crisis mode, that they should put their personal safety and the safety of their families first. And Ben, as a person who runs USAID, I also must say that all the programming we've been doing in the country, the beating heart of USAID's work around the world is our local staff.
Yeah.
You know, of the 10,000 people who work for USAID globally, 4,000 are local nationals of the countries in which we work. So a big area of focus for our team is also helping ensure that those individuals are looking out for their families and their loved ones, and you know, that we are supporting them. And so most of them too, though, have chosen to stay in Kyiv. You know, more than 85% of USAID staff are staying right where they've lived, you know, for generations. Some have moved to Lviv. We, USAID, moved our mission director with the embassy to be in a position to continue that humanitarian planning and to be supporting our partners. But everybody else is still working for the USAID mission in Ukraine, just doing so remotely, as the pandemic, of course, had forced us to do well before this crisis.
And so looking, I mean, again, it appears like, you know, this could be the worst case scenario. But, you know, President Biden himself has referred to potential for an effort to take Kyiv. Inhabiting a worst case scenario of a large scale Russian military invasion. I imagine that you mentioned displaced peoples. There's the issue of internally displaced peoples that you kind of alluded to. There's also, I guess, potential for refugee flows. Have you talked to neighboring countries? Is there a plan for the potential of large numbers, if not millions, of Ukrainians being displaced inside the country or moving into neighboring states? And is that kind of the principal role that USAID would play in the event of a significant escalation from here?
I spoke today, in fact, with the Polish official tasked with figuring out how Poland would respond to a mass refugee flow.
Yeah.
And it was quite reassuring. I mean, again, those aren't happy conversations under any circumstances, but you know, they are enlisting emergency preparedness, firefighters, others to be in a position if needed to build transit facilities. But the most important indication, of course, is how welcoming they're prepared to be to Ukrainians. So I think, you know, you would see a very, very open door, and it's not as if Polish citizens need to be reminded of the specter of Russian repression or aggression. So I think there are already an awful lot of family ties and work ties. There are more than 1 million Ukrainians live and work in Poland today already. And so the combination, I think, of humanitarian visas, work permits, asylum grants, I think there'll be a good welcome. And again, I think Poland's in a strong position to be able to welcome even the more extreme scenarios of numbers of Ukrainians coming across. Inside Ukraine, again, for months, we've been trying to use the information that we had to ensure that there was multiple scenarios being taken into account and not just, again, a memory of what happened in 2014 or 2015 and an assumption that that it would be more of the same. And just to give you one example of one of the outcomes of that, the World Food Program actually was involved in Ukraine in the immediate crisis of 2014, 2015, around then, and then pulled out a few years ago, believing that it had kind of stabilized. And even though there's mass humanitarian need in the East still around the line of conflict, it was just different organizations that were meeting those needs. Well, the World Food Program, because of the appeals that we've been making to be ready for any scenarios, is now back and positioned to be supportive of efforts to help internally displaced. Again, until we know precisely how Russian troops would enter and the particular vectors of displacement, what we have are kind of multiple playbooks, basically, depending on these different scenarios. But I do feel like we've had several months to prepare, and hopefully there'll be a chaos as always at the beginning, but we'll be in a position to meet the needs of these individuals who just don't deserve any of what's coming at them.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate the work that not only you, but as you said, your local staff and everybody's doing. It's so important, and it's such a contrast to the kind of worldview that Vladimir Putin represents and that he spoke about yesterday in that kind of unhinged rant. I wanted to ask you about COVID as well. Obviously, that's been a very strong focus of yours. Last time you were on, we talked about your kind of at that time nascent efforts to begin to disseminate vaccines and deal with vaccine inequity around the world. We're now at this kind of strange phase of the virus where some countries are trying to go back to normal. We don't know if there's going to be a new variant, but what remains the case is that the best protection against even new variants, right, is the broadest possible vaccination of the global public. What is the current state? What's your current focus? I think people may see occasionally announcements of this many doses going to this country, but strategically, where do you see this effort going now? And what are you focused on in terms of the next phase of the COVID fight?
Thank you for asking, because I do think there's some in the world who want to move on. And you know, we really do believe until everybody's safe, nobody's safe. And while, it's true that Omicron, which was so transmissive, mercifully proved far less deadly, in part because so many people had been vaccinated, but also in part because it was a less deadly variant. The next variant may not look like Omicron. And so we cannot take our feet off the gas as we think about the global effort to bring about mass vaccination. Where we are now is that we are focused on the WHO target of getting 70% of the world vaccinated by the end of this year.
Okay.
And that's a target that President Biden embraced last September at a summit where he convened the world's leaders to kind of rally behind that target. And honestly, the gating issue that we talked about when we were last together, I think, it was supply, right? Yeah. That's where a lot of the equity questions were fairly raised about how we and our families were able to get vaccinated well before a single vaccination might have reached a high-risk person, in most developing countries. Well, President Biden, starting last June, began to lead the world by donating vaccines, and we now have commitments of 1.3 billion vaccines that we've made to distribute for free. No strings attached. That's a distinguishing feature of the U.S.'s so-called vaccine diplomacy. And again, we view it as both good for the countries that are receiving the vaccines and of course, in our own public health interests. So very much something we hope the American people can rally behind. The thing is, though, Ben, one of the things that we found as the vaccines really began to flow, and this was in kind of November, December, we're talking about 4 million vaccines, you know, landing in a sub-Saharan African capital, is that until the kind of water was flowing through the pipes, yeah. You know, until it was real, not an abstract, okay, we want our vaccines, here's our plan, but real flowing. It was only then that we could see the kind of holes in the pipes.
And
it was the same in the United States. So this isn't even an issue specific to developing countries. It just was that their vaccines were entering the pipeline far later than ours were. And so we got those startup costs we bore early and often. And we have the health infrastructure, the tremendous health infrastructure that we have here. And most of these countries lack that. So what we did in the beginning of December is I launched something called Global Vax. And this is an effort to say, look, we're actually at a point now where the major gating issue is no longer supply. That may be an issue down the line. We're going to have to boost the world, you know, but the gating issue now is actually turning vaccines into vaccinations, getting those shots in arms, reaching that last mile, making sure that we're hitting stadiums and places of worship and making vaccines accessible. Because for all the talk of misinformation and hesitancy, and believe me, that exists in sub-Saharan Africa, just as it exists here in the United States, the number one impediment, particularly to getting up in the 50, 60, 70%, is not even misinformation or hesitancy or resistance. It's just that you got to take off work to schlep 20 miles to get to a clinic, or maybe you don't have the cold chain storage that you need in order to be able to store Pfizer, which is the vaccine.
You can't go down the street to CVS, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So what we're doing with Global Vax, which is building on the platforms that we have through PEPFAR, our HIV/AIDS program, which has been such a flagship success for so long and has such bipartisan support, is building on some of those platforms, because those clinics, those health workers, you know, they can be trained as well to be involved in this effort, is to really focus on delivery. And I just offer, because it's a bit of a dark time on planet Earth, but offer some pretty inspiring facts and statistics here around this effort. Basically, in Zambia, for example, where there's a new reformist government, one of the great bright spots in sub-Saharan Africa in terms of governance, the government decided to launch a campaign in December and just decided we're going to go all out for a month and see where we get to. And again, the number one issue, not hesitancy, but accessibility. In a single province called the Copper Belt Province, they went from 12 to 22% vaccinated in just a single month.
Yeah.
Just surging resources, surging public service announcements, getting sports figures and politicians and religious leaders on side to be helpful. In Uganda, it's even a more dramatic story where the country has gone for first doses. They went from 14% to 47% in just 6 weeks.
Huh.
So 14 to 47% of first doses. And once you've got your first dose in, that's proof of concept, right? Yeah. Then you know, it's easier to get people to come back. And 5 of the 9 regions in Uganda are now over 55% for first doses. So again, there are legitimate, I mean, we will all go back over the last couple of years and ask, what could we have done differently to get these vaccination numbers up sooner? But by investing in the local plans, in the national health ministries, using our malaria, our TB, our HIV/AIDS, and our other public health partnerships that we at USAID and other government agencies like CDC, have maintained for so long, I think we really can surge these numbers and start to see a virtuous cycle, so that even if we can't get all the way to 70% in every single country, that we get the vast majority of developing countries across that threshold.
Yeah, no, that's good to hear. And we want to keep people updated on this, because it's, it as important as any story in the world, doesn't get a ton of attention. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the bright spot of Zambia, and it kind of triggered in my mind, if you and I were, sitting around having a drink. One of the things that you are usually good at is kind of identifying that bright spot out there in the world, that small country that is proving the haters wrong on a democratic transition, or people who are resisting an encroachment or an effort by Russia to interfere in their affairs. I mean, what do you guys obviously do a lot of work on the nexus of democracy and development. It looks pretty dark out there right now. Putin has seized the global conversation. Where do you see green shoots of stories that we have not, you know, fully matured, but that we need to get behind in terms of, people out there fighting against the current in some cases? I mean, I'm offering you the chance to give our world those something to grab onto for some hope out there as an example of people. And you'd mentioned when I saw you in Glasgow, Zambia, for example, it could be one example, but what's out there that we should know about?
Yeah, I've been giving Zambia a lot of airtime, no matter whatever I can. But okay, I'll give you a few examples of countries, but then just to pull it back a little bit, because I think the green shoot is also a little bit philosophical, maybe. So in our own hemisphere, I'm really impressed with the Dominican Republic's efforts to combat corruption and to revamp their police force almost from scratch. And this is something we're in a strategic dialogue, strategic partnership with them. So, you know, kind of wonky stuff that one important. Doesn't pay that much attention to, but, you know, new procurement laws that just have much more transparency that sort of smokes out a little bit like the Open Government Partnership that you and I were involved in back in the Obama days and which is still thriving. I think there's a real opportunity there to back this reform effort. It's challenged, of course, by living next door to Haiti and all of the challenges that Haiti faces and the influx of Haitians who are living in such despair and lawlessness. But you do see political will to build institutions and a real recognition, I think, on the part of the leadership. To again, President Obama's point back in that Ghana speech a long time ago, that what the country needs is not a strong leader or a strong man, but strong institutions. And so more of an investment in that than I think we've seen in the neighborhood for some time. I work a lot and USAID works a lot in the Northern Triangle countries because of course, the need to deal with root cause of migration and also because of the development support that those countries need. There is a new president in Honduras who has committed to reconstituting the UN structure to fight corruption in her country. She's the first female head of state, you know, in the three Northern Triangle countries that we've had. And I got to travel with Kamala Harris down to be part of the inauguration. She has her work cut out for her. And there's obviously a huge amount of political polarization in that country.
Yeah.
But again, the more that we see leaders, and it's not an accident that corruption is what is animating so much of the leadership, you know, when there is a change in government, it's often the people speaking about how disgusted and fed up they are by what has come before. So, you know, when leadership bring in outside institutions recognizing, you know, the importance of independent rule of law, and again, the verdict is out as to whether that will stick and whether it will be truly independent rule of law. But I think that's something, again, that we want to work at the United Nations to support as quickly as we can.
Yeah.
So that's in the hemisphere. I think the two best examples in Africa are Zambia, where the current president, I think he was arrested something like 18 times before he somehow managed to win. They basically, the prior government, which was Chinese-backed and did the worst deals for the future of the Zambian people with the Chinese government, allowing the mineral riches of the country to be ravaged and accruing such debt. But they didn't even let the current president even campaign. And it was young people who just said enough, like we don't, if our opposition candidate here can't campaign, we're going to campaign on his behalf. And so he was swept into office again. When such a large share of your GDP goes to servicing debt, not of your making, you know, the odds are really tough. I mean, he's up against an awful lot. But, you know, as we see in the COVID vaccination drive, there is a commitment to good governance and to partnership and to shifting away from, you know, the kind of infrastructure arrangements that look so attractive to these countries in the short term. But in Zambia, all they saw was Chinese workers coming in and building the infrastructure and then projects that had such large cost overruns and now debt, you know, that will take generations to pay off. So there's a lot of buyer's remorse there. And what's really important is that not only that USAID and other US agencies are in there, but that we draw the private sector and other civil society actors and foundations to these opportunities that exist in sub-Saharan Africa. I want just to pull back though, if I could, Ben, for a second, because I could give you little isolated examples around the world. There aren't that many, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did want to just talk for a second about what President Biden did in convening the world's leaders, you know, at the Democracy Summit in early December. And I just feature, there were a couple features of that that I think are worth underscoring. First, we actually rolled out really interesting, fresh democracy programming. And I'll just offer like a few examples from the USAID side of the house, which is, you know, one of the oligarchs and dictators' tools that they have sort of brought online in recent years is basically to sue people who are uncovering their yeah. corrupt yeah. misdeeds.
Yeah.
And one of my first meetings I had actually was with Ukrainian journalists and civil society members in my first week in the job. They were describing that the yeah. playing field was never level.
Yeah.
But now it's even less level because, you know, these guys have a ton of money to throw at lawsuits and, you know, you're plucky civil society or Transparency International chapter,
yeah.
you know, are operating, you know, a little bit more hand to mouth.
That happened, by the way, Sam, you mentioned Catherine Benton, who was on this program, who wrote Putin's People. That happened to her. All the oligarchs sued her for libel. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So this is like the autocrat's playbook, right,
yeah.
which evolves. And so we have to watch how it evolves. And so what we've done is we've created a defamation fund, basically, where in a sense, it's like insurers aren't all that anxious necessarily
yeah,
to insure
yeah.
those actors who are uncovering, you know, the Panama Papers, or the Pandora Papers, or whoever, whatever is the local version of that in any particular country. But if we can think about this as a collective, so we're now going to be contributing to this fund that we're helping design, bringing other donors, foundations to bear to try to insulate against these really important actors so that they're able to do their work without this specter of being shut down or jailed.
Yeah.
So it's not a panacea, don't get me wrong, but it's an example, I think, of what are the tools we need for this moment, not the moment in the 1990s when
yeah.
some of the democracy programming was first rolled out. The second thing relates to what you alluded to earlier, which is, is there a way when there's a democratic opening to channel not just more democracy assistance, you know, not just more support for the civil society partner that's holding that government accountable or,
yeah.
you know, election integrity assistance, which, of course, we need to be doing as well, given Russia and China's, you know, interference in you know, election campaigns and so forth. All that is incredibly important. But what a reformer most needs to show his or her people is that there is a dividend. It's what President Biden talks about here domestically so much. And so another thing that we are doing at USAID, to your point, is to try to marry our democratic opening with our development assistance and our development programming.
Yeah.
And as USAID administrator, I'm also the vice chair of the Development Finance Corporation, which is run by Scott Nathan. And we're talking a lot to them about, okay, well, what does it mean to bring in development finance, you know, what about loan guarantees?
Yeah.
How can we bring private sector delegations to places that are doing really hard things so that it isn't just, again, that you have strengthened your election monitoring presence, right, your democracy programming,
yeah.
but that actually the people can see that there are more job opportunities or that the recovery from COVID happens at a more accelerated pace than it might have. So these are just a couple examples, but
yeah.
if you look at what came out of the Democracy Summit, I just really, for the first time, had a sense that we're really freshening our way of thinking about what this fight is. The second thing I wanted to just mention about it is it really has had the effect of causing Russia and China to be just talking an awful lot about democracy.
Yeah, I noticed.
And,
yeah,
and, yeah. and you know, it's a, I don't know. I don't know if you can take it as exactly affirming, but they do spend a lot of time, President Xi, President Putin, the ministers around them, talking about how irrelevant the Democracy Summit was more on the defensive, it feels, in terms of messaging about the relative merits of different systems and even claiming the democracy mantle
yeah. Yeah.
in China's case to an extent, I think, that we hadn't seen before. So again, it's all complicated to integrate human rights and democracy into American foreign policy in a consistent way. All your listeners know that better than I do. And so there are no panaceas, but I think that that summit, if we can actually act on what President Biden and the other leaders who gathered launched, which is a year of action, where we take the commitments that various leaders made, whether to give democracy support to countries that need it, including subnational actors, not just you know, leaders like we've been talking about, but also that there were countries that are were sort of controversial even to be at the summit, some of them, and some just experiencing these openings like Moldova, Zambia, Dominican Republic, like we discussed. If we can throw our weight behind those reformist efforts, I think it's really important, because there's no better talking point or proof point of the merits of the democratic approach than a democratic reformer actually being able to deliver on the promises that they have made by creating a more welcoming business environment, by creating economic opportunities because there's less corruption. You know, if we can we can have examples where doing the political reform and economic reform work translates into results for citizens, it feels like that is going to be ultimately the greatest rebuttal to the Chinese effort, which is so well resourced to create this kind of narrative of self-fulfilling prophecy of democracy's retreat.
Well, look, it's a great note of you know, not maybe not optimism, but like get to work from you to end on, because I mean it ties together. Like the thing about Ukraine and Putin is, you know, he wants this conversation to be entirely about, you know, his view, dueling view of Ukraine and history and all the rest of it, NATO with ours. There's a much bigger contest out there between what Putin represents and what Xi Jinping represents, and what people who want to have the capacity to control their own destiny, whether it's a country like Ukraine or whether it's an individual around the world. This is what's at stake. So it's not just sanctions that have to be the response to what's happening. It has to be an investment in the kind of approaches that you just talked about. Look, thanks for joining us. How are Declan and Reen doing? Some of our listeners may keep up with the Power Sunstein family.
They're okay. You remember Declan's immortal line when he was six and I was an absent parent.
Putin.
And it was Putin. When is it ever going to be Declan? And now I think he's old enough to really see the human stakes of this. So it's even more pronounced, I think, the focus on what's happening in the world, in our household. And like you know, we all struggle to talk to our kids in a manner that they can understand. Yeah. I mean, on one level, Putin is the most understandable to kids who watch, you know, superhero movies, right? Where there are archetypal, you know, villains who come in and take things from people that they don't belong. So on one hand, it seems so explicable, but then, you know, our kids are growing up in a world that just has a feel of volatility and danger that, you know, the last couple generations haven't had that same feeling. And so, hopefully, we can enlist them in the cause of making our world and our society better, and not have them turn off, from events that just seem bigger than them. But anyway,
that's
a parenting challenge that we all face.
It is a challenge. And, I was hardened myself. I watched the Kenyan, speech at the Year Old Stomping Grounds at the UN. And it's a reminder though, that you have to remind your kids that most people are fundamentally decent, you know? There's some bad leaders out there and some bad forces, but, it's not a reason to give up on other people. But hey, Sam, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to catch up like this, and I hope to catch up with you in person soon.
You too, Ben. Thank you.
Thanks to Samantha Power, as always, for joining us and for her great work. Thanks to Max Seddon as well for giving us that perspective from Moscow. Thanks to you for sticking with us through every step of this crisis. We will endeavor to keep you updated no matter what happens as we can, and we'll see you either next week or, if need be, before.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Yale Freed, and Phoebe Bradford, who film and share our episodes as videos each week.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Chapter 1, Wayfair welcomes you to the Waberhood. Our hero, Titus Burgess, ambled down the stylish street of an enchanting utopia. A woman waved from a chic lounger. "Welcome to the Waberhood," she said, "where Wayfair helps everyone create a home they love." Titus stared in awe. Bohemian Boulevard, Trendsetter Terrace, Mid-Century Circle.
Titus, You're reading the Wayfair catalog.
Oh, you'll love Chapter 2. Wayfair's fast and free shipping saves a potluck.
Wayfair, every style, every home.